Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Monday, the 15th of January, 2024. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. Here's Carol with our first story.
Oh, this one affects us all. Wind chill warning issued. Wind chills could reach 45 below zero. Due to life-threatening wind chills of 30 to 45 below, the National Weather Service has issued a wind chill warning through Tuesday morning across all Quad Cities area counties. Area temperatures are forecasted to top out at minus 2 degrees on Monday afternoon and reach a high of zero by Tuesday, according to the NWS. Monday and Tuesday morning, lows could reach 18 below and 15 below, respectively. Meteorologists project blowing snow conditions will lessen during this time. It's pretty much stopped out there, NWS meteorologist Peter Speck said Sunday afternoon. We are full visibility. According to NWS Quad Cities, wind chill warnings historically come roughly 2 out of every 3 winters. With these dangerously cold and wind chill estimates, meteorologists suggest canceling outdoor plans, limiting one's time spent outside, or dressing with at least 3 layers on, 1 layer insulating, if needed to go outside. For more cold weather preparations and safety tips, including hypothermia warning signs, visit www.weather.gov/safety/cold. Meteorologists also forecast west wind gusts reaching 15 to 20 miles per hour through Tuesday morning. Those who have to travel are encouraged to add items like food, water, blankets, a flashlight, and a shovel to your vehicle. Keep cell phones charged and inform others of planned departure and arrival times. People who have to be outside should cover exposed skin and spend as little time outdoors as possible. Speck said, make sure you have a full tank of gas, emergency kit, shovel in your car, extra salt, anything that can weigh down your car. He also advises to keep water pipes and faucets trickling to avoid freezing, citing MidAmerica Energy's recommendations. On Sunday, blowing and drifting snow continued across much of the Quad Cities area, causing a winter weather advisory. These conditions led to low visibility and snow-covered roads, particularly in more rural areas. On Sunday, the Scott County Emergency Management Agency, known as EMA, released a statement urging all area residents to check road conditions before traveling. The statement read, some rural roads remain impassable, and abandoned vehicles are slowing the progress to clear the roadways. If you do not need to travel in rural Scott County, consider staying home. City road conditions vary, so please check with your city's website or social media page or Iowa 511 for more details. Scott County EMA also urged residents not call 911 to request plows or check plowing statuses. They said road crews are working tirelessly to reestablish travel routes under challenging conditions from high winds and frigid temperatures. If needing to travel, check road conditions on 511ia.org for Iowa residents. For Illinois, visit gettingaroundillinois.com. To submit a storm report, visit ins.ncep.noaa.gov/report. The NWS will release another winter weather update at 5 a.m. on Monday. That was today. To view regular updates, visit weather.gov.dvn. A historical glimpse at Quad City weather It was exactly 45 years ago this weekend that 18.4 inches of snow fell from January 12th through January 14th, 1979. It was part of the great blizzard that struck the Quad Cities in December 1978 into January of 1979. That 18.4 inches that fell over 3 days remains the record amount for a single snowstorm in the Quad Cities, said meteorologist Peter Speck of the National Weather Service in Davenport. On January 15, 1979, the National Weather Service in Davenport recorded an official snow depth of 28 inches from all the snow that had fallen from late December of 1978 through January 14, 1979. A total of 26.7 inches of snow fell during the month of January 1979. However, that record was broken in 2019 when 30.2 inches of snow fell in the Quad Cities. However, January 6th through 12th in 2024 is the snowiest week on record in the Quad Cities with a record of 25.5 inches of snow from two systems. Speck said the snow depth at the National Weather Service office in North Davenport is 15 inches. There is some good news on the horizon. By Monday of next week, it is possible the temperatures will be back into the 30s. Speck said to take those predictions with a grain of salt. However, because the snowpack will mitigate that heat wave somewhat. Back to Jeff.
Well, we're not alone. Millions across the U.S. face sub-zero temperatures. Sub-freezing temperatures across much of the U.S. left millions of Americans facing potentially dangerous cold Sunday as Arctic storms threatened near-blizzard conditions in the Northeast and several inches of snow in parts of the South. The National Weather Service warned that windy sub-freezing conditions in Montana and the Dakotas could push wind chills as low as minus 70 degrees. An estimated 95 million people were under weather warnings or advisories for wind chills below zero, according to the Weather Service. Forecasters said the severe cold was expected to push as far south as northern Texas. Juan Villegas wore layers of clothing beneath his heavy coat Sunday as he and roughly a dozen subcontractors with shovels cleared snow in downtown Des Moines, where snow covered park benches and partially buried fire hydrants on the day before the state's presidential caucuses. Working in temperatures of minus 15 degrees, Villegas said the best way to feel warm is just to keep moving. If you stay doing nothing, that's when you feel really cold, Villegas said. Much of Wisconsin remained under advisories through Monday afternoon, with predicted wind chills as low as 30 degrees below zero. Even parts of northern Louisiana, Alabama, and Georgia could see snow. In Shreveport, Louisiana, Mary Trammell was among residents who stocked up on bottled water, food, and fuel for generators ahead of sub-freezing weather forecasts to bring up an inch of snow and leave roads coated in ice. "It's cold out here," said Trammell, who told KSLA-TV she bought bread and ingredients for enough soup to last days. "I can get what I need and make sure the house is stored good." Officials warned people to stay off the roads in Buffalo, New York, where snowfall of 1 to 2 feet was forecast. The storm forced the postponement of the Buffalo Bills-Pittsburgh Steelers NFL playoff game from Sunday to Monday. Workers with shovels and trucks worked Sunday to clear snow from the field at Buffalo's Highmark Stadium. In a post on X, formerly Twitter, the Bills implored fans eager to lend a hand to hold off and await word when it'll be safe to travel. "Looks like a pretty good day to not have a football game," New York Governor Kathy Hochul, a Buffalo native, posted on X with a video clip of whiteout conditions in western New York. At least one Bills player was out in bad weather Sunday, putting his newfound free time to good use. Offensive tackle Ryan Von Denmark shared a video on Instagram showing fellow lineman Alec Anderson helping a motorist struggling with icy road conditions. Good Samaritan Alec helping the people, Van Denmark narrates on the brief clip posted Sunday. Zach Taylor, a National Weather Service meteorologist in College Park, Maryland, warned some parts of the Northeast could see intense snowfall and extreme wind with gusts up to 50 miles per hour possible. That's why they're expecting to see near blizzard conditions at times, Taylor said. Airports across the country were impacted. More than half of the flights into and out of Buffalo Niagara International Airport were canceled. Scores of flights were also canceled or delayed at Chicago O'Hare International Airport, Denver International Airport, and Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. Forecasters also warned that rapid bursts of heavy snow and wind could cause drastic and sudden drops in visibility in eastern Pennsylvania and parts of northern New Jersey and Delaware. The Weather Service warned squalls could bring near whiteout conditions and a quick 1/2 inch of snow in just 10 to 15 minutes. Another Arctic storm that dumped heavy snowfall in the Rockies was forecast to push further south, potentially bringing 4 to 6 inches of snow to parts of Arkansas, northern Mississippi, and west Tennessee. Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders declared a state of emergency in advance to give utility trucks and trucks hauling essential supplies greater flexibility to respond. Officials in Mississippi's capital city of Jackson were preparing for days of freezing weather after cold snaps in 2021 and 22 caused pipes to burst and water pressure to drop across the city of 150,000. We feel as confident as we can that we're prepared for whatever comes our way, Ted Henneflin, Jackson's interim manager of Jackson's long troubled water system, told WAP-TV. He said 14 crews were on standby to respond to any broken pipes. The wild weather didn't just bring snow and ice. Record high tides that flooded some homes in Maine and New Hampshire on Saturday also swept three historic fishing shacks into the sea from the spot where they had stood in South Portland, Maine, for more than 130 years. History is just being washed away, Michelle Erskine said Sunday, a day after she captured video footage of the last two wooden shacks sliding into the ocean. More than 162,000 homes and businesses in Oregon were without electricity Sunday following heavy snow and ice storms, according to PowerOutage.us. We're still battling the elements, but our crews are focused on repair and restoration as the weather allows, said Eric Brookhouse, Vice President of System Operation for Pacific Power. We thank our customers for their patience and understanding as we continue this work in what can be treacherous conditions. The harsh weather in Oregon played a role in three deaths, according to authorities. Weather-related deaths were reported earlier in California, Idaho, Illinois, and Wisconsin. Widespread power outages affecting tens of thousands were also reported in Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin.
And since today is caucus day for the GOP, there's an article printed yesterday, How to Caucus in Scott County. Caucus night on Monday may go down in the history books as the coldest ever. Forecasts predict temperatures to be -7 by caucus time. Scott County GOP chairwoman said the GOP is still expecting a strong turnout despite the cold temperatures, but probably not record-breaking. Janita McNulty said, "Before, we were expecting record-breaking numbers over 2016, but now with frigid temperatures, we're not expecting to break records. But we're still expecting good turnout, especially folks really committed to their candidate." And here is how and where to caucus on tonight, Monday night. When and where is my caucus? Caucuses will take place 7 p.m. January 15th. Officials advise arriving early by 6:30 p.m. Finding your caucus site requires two steps. Your caucus site is based on your voting precinct, which you can look up at the Secretary of State's website or the County Auditor's Office. Then check your location with the Iowa Republican website, iowagop.org/2024caucus, or the Iowa Democrats website, iowademocrats.org/caucus/. In Scott County, Democrats will caucus at Davenport North High School, 626 West 53rd Street in Davenport. What happens at a caucus? Iowans meet, I guess, it's a pretty foregone conclusion for the Democrats. What happens at a caucus? Iowans meet according to party preference in schools, public buildings, and churches on caucus night. In addition to selecting a preferred candidate, presidential candidate, caucus goers typically elect committee members and talk party platform. For Republicans, before the presidential preference poll, representatives from each campaign can make speeches in support of their candidate. Caucus goers can then write their preference for the Republican presidential nominee on a slip of paper. Those votes are counted and announced to the caucus site and reported to the state party. A representative from each campaign may watch the tabulation. Unlike in past Iowa Democratic caucuses, where Iowans stood in corners of the room to be counted, Republicans keep their choices a secret. For Democrats, there's a big change this year. Instead of declaring support for a presidential candidate at the caucuses, the party is conducting a mail-in system. At the caucuses themselves, on January 15th, Democrats will discuss party business, such as electing committee members and discussing party platform. To request a presidential preference card, Iowa Democrats can fill out an online form or download a printable form, fill it out, email it, or return it in the mail. The last day to request a preference card is February 19th. The party began mailing out preference cards on Saturday. The party's new presidential preference cards will include the names of incumbent President Joe Biden and two long-shot challengers, U.S. Representative Dean Phillips, a Democrat from Minnesota, and author Marianne Williamson, along with an option to remain uncommitted. And who can caucus? Any person voting at a precinct caucus must be a registered voter and a resident of Iowa and a registered member of the political party living in the precinct in which they intend to caucus. Individuals may register to vote or change their party affiliation at the caucus. To register a vote in Iowa, you must be a U.S. citizen. You must be an Iowa resident. You must be at least 17 years old, as long as you will turn 18 on or before Election Day. You must not be judged mentally incompetent to vote by a court. You must not claim the right to vote in any other place. Iowans can register to vote online using the Iowa Department of Transportation's website or by downloading a voter registration form from the Iowa Secretary of State's website. That's sos.iowa.gov, and mailing the form to their county auditor. Iowans also can register to vote in person on the day of the Iowa caucuses by showing up to their caucus site and bringing documents, including ID and proof of residency. Iowans can check their voter registration status and find more information at voterready.iowa.gov/register-to-vote. And what do I need to bring to my caucus site? Iowa voters planning to participate in the Iowa caucuses will need to bring a valid form of ID on caucus night, which includes Iowa voter identification card, Iowa driver's license, Iowa non-operative ID, U.S. military ID or veteran ID, U.S. passport, tribal ID card or document. Those who plan to register to vote at their precinct location on caucus night also will need to bring the following: a valid form of ID as listed above, a proof of address, such as residential lease, utility bill, bank statement, paycheck, government check, property tax statement, or government document, etc. And this was article was by Tom Barton of the Gazettes, who contributed to this report. Jeff?
Affordable housing is eyed for complex. The late 1800s era Annie Wittenmeyer complex in Central Davenport could become affordable family and senior housing under a proposal by experienced historic preservation developer Chris Ailes. The 32-acre complex off Eastern Avenue, which was once a home for children orphaned by the Civil War, is recognized as a state and national historic landmark. Its use evolved for social services in the mid-20th century, and the city of Davenport took over ownership in the 1970s. But years of buildings sitting vacant and underused meant there wasn't enough revenue for the routine maintenance, according to city officials. With millions in deferred maintenance, the city sought a new owner and use for the property. The city invited developers to tour the campus 5 years ago and now is considering a development proposal by Ailes to turn the complex into 99 total affordable rental units, including 52 for seniors and 47 for families. This week, there will be two public hearings where the public will have a chance to weigh in. The Planning and Zoning Commission will hold a public hearing at 5 p.m. on Tuesday at City Hall on rezoning the property, and the City Council will hold a public hearing at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday at the City Council Chambers over an agreement to give temporary site control of the campus to Ailes and his development partners to apply for state and federal tax credits, among other funding, for the project. The proposed agreement, which must be approved by the City Council, would permit Ailes and his development partners roughly 1 year to secure the necessary financing. If successful, the city would transfer the property to the developer by 2025. If not, the agreement would expire. Ailes expects the project will require about $40 million to accomplish. Ailes is working with Brian Fritz, owner of Pioneer Property Management, who's likely to own the complex once finished, along with Jim Bergman, who owns the Call building. Ailes is serving as a consultant, he said, particularly regarding historic preservation. Ailes is still working through a building-by-building concept for the complex, but under his high-level plan, no buildings would be demolished. The city would retain the Annie Wittenmeyer Aquatic Center, and most existing nonprofits could continue leasing space at the complex. The first step is doing our best to accommodate all the folks that have been occupying the campus and desire to stay there, Ailes said. That includes Davenport Junior Theater, Family Resources, and Community Action of Eastern Iowa's Head Start program. City officials have also indicated they're exploring potential partnership with Davenport Schools and Junior Theater. Ailes said they've also talked with Tapestry Farms, a refugee services organization that grows fresh produce, but the developers don't think they'll be able to continue leasing the current brick building at the southwest corner of the campus. Ann McGlynn, the executive director of Tapestry Farms, is excited about the prospect of more affordable housing located close to services like a grocery store, schools, and bus lines, even if it means the organization possibly leaving its home on the Wittenmeyer campus. If it so happens that some of our families are able to live on that campus, that will personally give me great joy, McGlynn said. And I look forward to the day when I can drive by the building that's now ours and know that someone's living there and able to build a good life because they have stable housing. Ailes has more than two decades' experience doing or consulting on historic renovations in Davenport, including the conversion of the former Marycrest College into about 180 apartments, the call office building, which is 60 to 70 apartments, the former call nursing home, about 50 apartments, and St. Catherine's School in Davenport, about 40 apartments. Several have involved apartment conversions, but even if some, Wittenmeyer campus was previously designed for residential use, turning them into residential apartments will involve lots of upgrades, including new plumbing, electricity, heating, cooling, often new roofs, new mechanical systems, sprinklers, fire alarms, and elevators if needed, Ailes said. Although it may look simple, there are a lot of challenges just in the construction, Ailes said. The campus apartments would have income and rent restrictions because of financing requirements from the Iowa Finance Authority and other potential funding partners. Generally speaking, a substantial portion of the apartments will be limited to individuals with incomes at or below 60% of the area median income, and then the rents would be approximately a third of those incomes, Ailes explained. So a one-bedroom apartment might rent for $500 to $600, a two-bedroom $600 or $700, and the three-bedroom $700 to $800, again, as a general estimate. In the senior portion of the development, there'll be a mix of one- and two-bedroom apartments, depending on the building layouts. In the workforce housing component, there'll be some one, two, and perhaps three, maybe even some four-bedroom apartments, Ailes said.
And from Des Moines, principal dies of injuries from school shooting. An Iowa principal who put himself in harm's way to protect students during a school shooting earlier this month died Sunday, a funeral home confirmed. Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory confirmed the death of Perry High School principal Dan Marburger after the family announced it on GoFundMe page. Marburger was critically injured during the January 4th attack, which began in the school's cafeteria as students were gathered for breakfast before class. An 11-year-old middle school student was killed in the shooting, and six other people were injured. The 17-year-old student who opened fire also died of an apparent gunshot inflicted wound. The day after the shooting, the State Department of Public Safety said Marburger acted selflessly and placed himself in harm's way in an apparent effort to protect his students. News of Marburger's death was first posted on a GoFundMe page for his family. The post by Marburger's wife Elizabeth said he died at about 8 a.m. Sunday and said, "Dan lost his battle. He fought hard and gave us 10 days that we will treasure forever." The news that Marburger died triggered a flood of support on the Perry Facebook page, with nearly 200 people posting condolences within the first hour after it was posted. Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds offered her condolences, saying, "Our entire state is devastated by the news of Dan Marburger's death," she said in a statement on Sunday. Jeff?
Turning now to the obituaries. These were published yesterday in the Quad City Times. First, a pending notice. Ernest Lee Vaughn II, age 46, of Moline, passed away on Tuesday, January 9th at his home. Arrangements we made with Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. Mary Ellen Wall, December 4th, 1944 to January 7th, 2024. Mary Ellen Wall, age 79, passed away on Sunday, January 7th, after a courageous battle with lung cancer. Services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, the 17th, at Wirtz Funeral Home, 3625 Jersey Ridge Road in Davenport. The family will greet friends from 3 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, January 16th, at the funeral home. Burial will be at the National Cemetery in Rock Island Arsenal. Memorials can be made to the American Cancer Society or Toys for Tots. Mary Ellen was born on December 4, 1944 in Moline. She was the third child born to Jewel and Edith Wallert. Mary married George Richard Wall on February 6, 1965 in East Moline. Mary attended Willard Elementary School, John Deere Junior High, and Moline High School, graduating in 1962. After graduation, Mary worked as an administrative assistant at Amatech Incorporated. After being a stay-at-home mom for many years, Mary worked as an orthodontic office receptionist and as an orthodontic lab technician. Carol?
February 14th, 1923 to December 13th, 2023. Mary Catherine, known as Kay Drury of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, formerly of Bethesda, Maryland and Davenport, Iowa, passed away peacefully on December 13th, 2023 at the Kate B. Reynolds Hospice Home. She was 100 years old. During Kay's stint as an Iowan, she was executive secretary to Linda Downs, the first director of the Figge Art Museum, and later was quite active as a docent there. She even invited Bill Wundrum to follow her on her explanatory rounds of challenging, traveling show, believing that even the most radical art could be explained and appreciated by anyone. A celebration of her life will be held on February 14th, which is Kay's birthday, at the Hayworth Miller Funeral Home, 3315 Silas Creek Parkway in Winston-Salem. The family will receive visitors at 1 p.m., and the service will start at 2 p.m. Family and friends will gather after the ceremony at the Courtyard Winston-Salem Haynes Mall at 1600 Westbrook Plaza Drive. If Kay's friends and family would like to make a charitable donation in her name, Kay was a supporter of the Crossnore Communities for Children donation portal. Jeff?
Ruth E. Orwitz, November 11, 1935 to January 12, 2024. Ruth E. Orwitz, age 88, of Rock Island, passed away Friday, January 12th. At Silver Cross Nursing Center in Rock Island. A massive Christian burial will be held at 12 noon Friday, June 19th at St. Pius X Catholic Church, Rock Island. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. on Thursday at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory, Rock Island. Burial will be in Rock Island National Cemetery. Memorials may be left to St. Pius Catholic Church and Alleman High School. Ruth was born November 11, 1935 in Decorah, the daughter of Raymond and Helen O'Brien, Carolyn. She married Louis Orwitz on October 12, 1957 in Rock Island. Ms. Orwitz had been employed at the Rock Island Courthouse as a circuit clerk until her retirement in 1998. Carol?
Ralph J. Anderson, March 25, 1933 to December 24, 2023. Ralph J. Anderson, a distinguished man of integrity and resilience, gracefully departed this world on December 24, 2023, surrounded by the love of his family at Palm Beach Gardens Hospital. Age 90, Ralph's journey began March 25, 1933, in Des Moines, Iowa, born to Frank and Winifred Anderson. Embracing the entrepreneurial spirit, Ralph embarked on a successful business career, starting with Ernst & Ernst in Chicago. He later took the reins of the family business, Fiddler & Chambers Company in Davenport, Iowa. Under his leadership, The company expanded into office supplies, commercial printing, and groundbreaking governmental division. In 1988, he acquired Bateman and Associates, a software development company, which paved the way for technological solutions in the voting sector. A spiritual man, Ralph served as deacon at Bethany Baptist in Moline, Iowa, was a devoted member of Christ Fellowship Church in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to Christ Fellowship Church, Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, Louis Pello Organization, Portland, Oregon, or Moody Bible Institute, Chicago, Illinois. Cremation rites have been accorded, and a celebration of life memorial service will be held in the spring in Davenport, Iowa, with details to be announced later. Ralph's legacy of love, determination, and entrepreneurial spirit will continue to inspire generations to come.
Dr. Jeffrey Bassman, March 29, 1951 to January 12, 2024. Dr. Jeffrey Bassman, DDS of Davenport, passed away peacefully on Friday, January 12, at the age of 72. Jeff was born in Des Moines on March 29, 1951, to Father Morris Bassman and Mother Shirley Berg Bassman. He graduated from Roosevelt High School in Des Moines in 1969. Jeff went on to attend the University of Iowa, where he completed his doctorate of dental science and made lifelong friends, many through his membership in the Alpha Epsilon Pi fraternity. He moved to Davenport in 1977 and opened a dental practice, later specializing in pain management. A celebration of life will be held in Davenport in August 2024. Halligan McCabe DeBrees Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Further details will be found in Jeff's obituary at hmdfuneralhome.com.
Judith, known as Judy Stogsdill, November 16, 1942 to January 11, 2024. Judith, known as Judy Stogsdill, 81 of Moline, was called to heaven Thursday, January 11, 2024 at Allure of the Quad Cities. She was surrounded by family and friends. Judy was born November 16, 1942 in Davenport to Kenneth and Isel Gaiman Christensen. She worked as a supervisor in the finance department at the Department of Defense at the Rock Island Arsenal for 22 years prior to her retirement in 2002. She later spent many years caring for loved ones. A visitation celebration of life for Judy will begin at 10 a.m. on Monday, January 15, 2024, at Halligan McCabe DeVry Funeral Home in Davenport. The funeral service will follow the visitation at 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Burial will be in Davenport Memorial Park. Memorials may be made to the Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. Jeff?
Clark R. House, Jr., July 14, 1953 to December 21, 2023. Clark R. House, Jr., PhD, passed away unexpectedly on December 21, 2023, in New Mexico while on a nationwide road trip. Clark was a realtor in Albany, Oregon at the time of his death. He was born in Davenport and graduated from Rich Central High School in Olympia Fields, Illinois. He received his PhD in psychology from the University of Nebraska. Gary E. Rule, December 8, 1937 to January 8, 2024. Gary Rule, age 86 of Davenport, passed away unexpectedly Monday, January 8th. Cremation will be done with a celebration of life to be held at a later date. Memorials in his name may be made to the Scott County Humane Society or Hope Church in Bettendorf. Condolences may be shared at rungimortuary.com. Gary was born December 8, 1937 in Davenport to Anselm and Evelyn Schluter Rule. He was united in marriage to Aileen McAllister on January 12, 1959 in Maquoketa. Gary had been a mechanic with the city of Davenport for 37 years before retiring in 1996.
And also from Davenport, Daniel Butler Martin III, March 7th, 1963 to January 10th, 2024. Daniel Butler Martin III, 60, of Davenport, passed away Wednesday, January 10th, 2024 at the University of Iowa Hospital. Per his request, cremation rites will be accorded. Online condolences may be left at rungimortuary.com. He was born in Wichita Falls, Texas, son of Daniel Butler Jr. and Colleen Taylor Martin. He married Linda Stewart Schebler on September 28, 2007 in Bettendorf. Let's see. He started working as an executive for Cox Cable in Asheville, North Carolina, and then owned his own consulting business and moved to Iowa around 2005. His career here started at Volt Temp Services, part of John Deere, and worked here for 3 years. Became director of the Blong Technical Center, part of Eastern Iowa Community College, and served 4 years. Following that, he served as Dean of Industrial Technology at Kirkwood College for 5 years. Most recently spent the last 2.5 years as program manager for PSMI based in Michigan for the John Deere Works factory. Jeff?
Dateline Eldridge, Earl Cool, June 13, 1935 to January 9, 2024. Earl H. Cool, age 88, of Eldridge, passed away on Tuesday, January 9th at Fieldstone of DeWitt. His funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, January 20th at Faith Lutheran Church in Eldridge. Visitation will be held from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. on Friday evening at the church. Burial will be in Pine Hill Cemetery in Davenport. Memorials may be made to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital or Faith Lutheran Church. Earl was born June 13, 1935 in Davenport, the son of Harvey and Elsie Hammond Cool. He attended DeWitt Central High School, graduated from Iowa State University, and served in the United States Air Force. Earl was united in marriage to Dorothy Steenbach on July 21, 1956, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Davenport. A lifelong farmer on the Cool Century Farm, Earl was with American Mutual Insurance for many years. Online condolences may be expressed to the family by visiting Earl's obituary at McGinnisChambers.com. Carol?
And also from Davenport, Jerry, known as Jody C. McMillan, June 23, 1962 to January 7, 2024. Jerry McMillan, 61, formerly of Davenport, Iowa, passed away January 7, 2024 in Powell, Tennessee, after a brief illness. Jerry was born to Jerry C. McMillan Sr. and Barbara Stewart McMillan on June 23, 1962. He was united in marriage to Sandra Dyke in Knoxville. Per Jerry's wishes, there will be no services, and the rite of cremation took place in Tennessee. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Jeff?
And finally, Patricia L. Powers, March 17, 1936 to January 9, 2024. Patricia L. Powers, age 87, of Tipton, died January 9th at Cedar Manor Nursing Home in Tipton following a brief illness. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, January 18th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Tipton. Burial will be at St. Mary's Cemetery. The Reverend Father James Flattery will officiate the services. Family and friends may call from 2 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, January 17th at Fry Funeral Home in Tipton, where parish rosary will be said at 7 p.m. Thoughts, memories, and condolences may be left at fryfuneralhome.com. Patricia married Frederick Powers on January 7th, 1956. They were married for 68 years. Surviving is her husband, Fred, four children, and numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Carol?
And that concluded obituaries for the day, and we'll go to the opinion page. This article is by Eugene Robinson. DeSantis and Haley have lost their way, according to this this article. Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley did not just lose Wednesday night's debate. They have lost their way. At Perry High School in Iowa last week, 17-year-old Dylan Butler shot and killed a sixth grader, wounded five other students and staff, then killed himself. Surely the Republican presidential candidates discussed the tragedy during the debate in Des Moines, right? Wrong. Neither said a word about a school shooting that had happened just days earlier and barely 40 miles away. Anyone still searching for a meaningful difference between today's Democratic Party and the GOP need only take note of their very different reactions to this latest tragedy. Deadly shootings, even in our schools, are an inevitable feature of our daily lives, according to the Republican Party. In comments and appearances before the debate, the leading GOP candidates all reacted to the Perry shooting by washing their hands of any duty to act, and of course by offering thoughts and prayers. DeSantis, the Florida governor, said during an interview with NBC News and the Des Moines Register that while officials have a responsibility to guarantee safety at our schools, the federal government is probably not going to be leading that effort. As though to underscore the point, he later said, according to Reuters, that as president he would sign a bill eliminating the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Haley posted her condolences on X, formerly known as Twitter, shortly after the shooting, saying in part that my heart aches for the victims of Perry, Iowa, and the entire community. Later that day, the former UN ambassador and South Carolina governor said, we have to deal with the cancer that is mental health, called for more security officers at schools, and went ahead with her campaign schedule. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump, expected to trounce DeSantis, Haley, and all other comers in Monday's Iowa caucuses, addressed school violence during a campaign stop on Friday. The callousness was breathtaking, even for Trump. He said, in Sioux City, I want to send our support and our deepest sympathy to the victims and families touched by the terrible school shooting yesterday in Perry, Iowa. It's just horrible, so surprising to see it here, but we have to get over it. We have to move forward. Get over it? Imagine the comfort that must have brought to the family of 11-year-old Amir Jolliffe, who was killed in the shooting. The Republicans' party's lack of empathy after such a tragedy as this gives the country a real chance to see why that matters for our country leadership and what a real difference the Democrats offer. On Thursday, the day after the Republicans' dismal debate, Vice President Harris visited a middle school in Charlotte to join a roundtable discussion on gun violence with Education Secretary Miguel Cardona. That's where she announced the administration's plan to invest a new round of funding, $285 million, for schools to find and train mental health professionals, per a White House official. Harris shared a reaction to the Perry shooting on X the day it occurred, highlighting some of the proposals Democrats have been trying to pass. And this is a quote, as we begin a new year, we must resolve to finally end this epidemic of gun violence that has become the leading cause of death for children in America. We know the solutions, making background checks, universal passing red flag laws, and renewing the assault weapons ban. Now Congress and state legislators across the country must have the courage to act. The measures the Vice President advocates, backed almost universally by Democratic officials and candidates, have overwhelming public support, according to poll after poll. But they are rejected and blocked by Republicans who fall over themselves to avoid even talking about the one element that's common to all mass shootings, the gun. What distinguishes the United States from other developed countries, where gun violence is less common by orders of magnitude, is easy access to firearms of all kinds, including weapons designed for military combat. President Biden answered Trump's brush-off during his speech Monday in Charleston, South Carolina, at Mother Emanuel AME Church, site of a 2015 massacre by a white supremacist. He said, "My response is, we have to stop it so your children, your family, your friends can leave your home, walk the streets, go to stores, go to the grocery store, go to church, to be safe from gun violence. There's no excuse for this carnage," he said. But Republicans continue to find excuses to avoid talking about guns. Some on the far right are even making the bizarre claims, unsupported by any facts, that people who identify as LGBTQ plus are somehow more likely to commit mass shootings. Donald Trump Jr. posted on X, "Per capita, is there a more violent group of people anywhere in the world than radicalized trans activists?" And the platform's owner, billionaire Elon Musk, responded to a different provocateur's post about the radicalization of LGBTQ youth by agreeing, "This is happening a lot. Something is deeply wrong." Good Lord. What is deeply wrong is the refusal by Republicans to do anything that might actually reduce gun violence and save innocent lives. If that is something you care about, vote in November to give Democrats the power to act. And this article was written by Eugene Robinson, who is a political columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. Jeff?
Choosing a president demands clear thinking. This op-ed by Don Wooten, who is a former Illinois state senator and a regular columnist for the Times. Wooten writes, "Tomorrow, the 2024 presidential campaign, which has been cluttering your TV and intruding into your news cycle for many months, will officially begin in sub-zero darkness at 1,657 locations across Iowa. This is a Republican-only event. Iowa Democrats will dutifully follow their national party's decree and delay their caucus until March 5th. Both parties will have their initial primaries in New Hampshire 8 days after tomorrow's caucus. Iowans insist that the Hawkeye State remain first in the nation for presidential elections. It's not only a point of pride, but also a financial bonanza for TV stations and establishments providing food, housing, and other amenities for candidates crisscrossing the state for months ahead of time, hoping to chalk up an early lead. Jimmy Carter's rise from obscurity in 1976 fueled a dream that doesn't always come true, but keeps inspiring the ambitious. The problem is that caucuses tend to be messy. Primaries are managed by professionals. Caucuses are run by party members and mistakes are made. A classic example is Rick Santorum's win in 2012, a result that wasn't confirmed until 3 weeks after Mitt Romney had been declared the victor, too late for Santorum to overcome Romney's running start. Both political parties have had problems getting an early, accurate count in Iowa, which is why all but 9 states now prefer statewide primaries. The holdout Republicans joining Iowa this year are Nevada, Idaho, Missouri, North Dakota, Alaska, Utah, Hawaii, and Wyoming. Democratic caucuses are limited to Iowa, Idaho, and Wyoming. Both parties hold caucuses in American territories. Primaries are clearly becoming the preferred option. Given the wretched forecast for tomorrow, for today, and the unhealthy grip he has on the GOP, Trump is expected to win by a sizable margin. It's true that polls don't always translate into votes, but other factors tilt the odds heavily in the former president's favor. For starters, there are too many candidates. Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis have pulled away from the pack, but the best either can hope for is second place. DeSantis has the full-throttle support of Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, who has placed a long-shot bet on being his vice president. But Haley seems to be edging ahead. There's scant hope for Haley being picked as Trump's VP. She would have to crawl to win his approval. The most likely option for Trump is Kristi Noem, governor of South Dakota. That's conventional thinking. The obvious isn't always the answer. Weather conditions could reduce attendance. While Trump's cult-like following is passionate enough to brave the elements, there may be rising ardor for DeSantis, giving Reynolds popularity. Trump's statements about future plans may be sufficiently alarming to cut into his lead. There may be a dawning awareness that polling gives Haley a great likelihood of defeating Biden than a greater likelihood of defeating Biden than Trump. Chances for an upset are slim, but odd things can happen in unusual circumstances. There's also an undercurrent of disgust at the whole spectacle. The political ads, which have multiplied beyond reason this week, are so poisonous that television station transmitters may have to be fumigated. Reagan's Morning in America has darkened into a midnight filled with lies,